It's The Takeaway for Thursday, August 15th. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today, three stories on the immigrant experience in the United States. Who deserves to come to the U.S.? We'll look at the role of race on immigration policy in light of the new public charge rules the Trump administration announced this week. And Hollywood's obsession with and portrayals of the Vietnam War. Novelist Viet Thanh Nguyen re-examines Apocalypse Now through the Vietnamese perspective.
I'm not taking away anything from his depiction of the American psyche or American character, but that drama is based on the erasure and the exploitation and silencing of Vietnamese people.
But first, families in Mississippi were disrupted last week when ICE officials arrested 680 people at seven food processing plants across the state in a one-day operation. The workplace immigration raids left some children without a parent, like this 11-year-old in Forest, Mississippi.
Governments, please put your heart. Let my parent be free with everybody else, please. Don't leave the child with crying and everything.
About 300 of those detained were released within 24 hours, giving some children at least one parent back. But raids like this are still difficult and frightening for children. Randy Capps has studied these impacts during the late years of the Bush administration, the last time the government regularly conducted these kinds of workplace raids. He's the director of research for U.S. programs at the Migration Policy Institute. Randy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tanzina, for having me on your program.
So the raids that happened last week were dramatic. There was lots of footage of children crying about having been separated from their parents so abruptly. Tell us what happens to children immediately after a workplace immigration raid takes place.
In most cases, it's one of the parents who gets arrested, and that parent, often the father, though I think in the Mississippi case it was a lot of mothers too, is the person who earns the most money. And the biggest issue is a drop in income. In our research, following up on about six different of these kinds of operations, families lost 70% of their income in the first few months and as much as 50% of 6 months to a year later. So the biggest issue then is the family has trouble affording housing. They may have trouble affording food and other basic necessities.
We talk a lot about the psychological trauma of being separated from parents. What have you found in your research? How does this impact a child's mental state?
Sometimes they don't know what happened because the parents don't want to tell them or don't want to tell them in detail. And then they don't know how long they're not going to see their parents if they're detained or deported. Sometimes detention can last 6 months or more. Children may, in the worst case, actually see their parents getting arrested, which is very traumatic. Usually at the workplace, they don't because the children aren't there. They're at school or at home. And then one of their parents just doesn't come home from work that day.
Many of the children in Mississippi have already started school. I can't imagine what that's like a week or so after having one of your parents caught up in a workplace immigration raid. Tell us more about the role that schools can play here in helping to stabilize the situation for these kids.
Well, it's a hard thing in these small towns, some of them 1,000 to 1,500 people, maybe close to 10% of the population might have been arrested. And so the schools play an important role because that's where the children are most of the day. The educators will get to know these children and hopefully be supportive of them. When we studied the Postville raid in Iowa in 2008, we found that some children actually did better in school after a parent was arrested because the teachers and the support staff in the schools went out of their way to help them.
If a parent is deported following a raid, what happens to the child then?
Well, after that raid in Iowa, there were a lot of deportations to Guatemala, and there was actually a filmmaker from Guatemala who followed them back to Guatemala and found the conditions that some of the children were living in, if they had returned with a parent, to be pretty basic, pretty low levels of development, especially in rural parts of Central America, big problems with housing, health, and basic food security. But most children stay here in the U.S. I mean, they have access to school here. They have much better living conditions. They have a better future. The problem is then they may be separated from one of their parents permanently or for a very long time.
Randy, let's look at this historically. You mentioned another raid that happened in the mid-2000s here. How similar is what we saw last week from what we've witnessed and what you've studied from that era?
There were a lot of similar operations at the end of the Bush administration between 2006 and 2008. There were 1,200 people arrested in 6 meatpacking plants across the Midwest and South. In Postville, Iowa, which is the largest single-site raid that ICE has ever conducted, 400 people were arrested at a kosher meatpacking plant. These operations are the ones then that net the most people and attract the most attention.
And, of course, the big picture for immigration today is quite different than during the Bush administration raids. And even Obama was called the deporter-in-chief, so there may have been less workplace raids, but still there were deportations happening. What do you think is different today about how this is unfolding for families and kids?
Well, in terms of the operation itself, it's remarkably similar to what happened at the end of the Bush administration. As you mentioned, the Obama administration stopped the workplace raids, but they focused more on getting people arrested by the local police through the criminal justice system. We've had ongoing large levels of arrests that subsided some at the end of the Obama administration, but it's back up again. What's new is the rhetoric of this administration, which is much more stridently anti-immigrant. Both Presidents Bush and Obama were in favor of legalizing at least some significant portion of the unauthorized population as part of immigration reform, whereas this administration has been asking Congress to cut legal immigration and been against any kind of legalization. Plus, you know, just this week, we've had the announcement of a public charge rule that would make it very difficult for any immigrant that uses benefits or is likely to use benefits to get a green card. We've had the cuts to refugees and the issues with asylum seekers at the border. So the overall context now is quite different.
I want to dig a little deeper into that because the idea of family separation is something that we've seen that has become much more visible, much more controversial during the Trump administration. We've seen this happening at the southern border with children as young as just months old are being separated from their parents. Does that factor into ICE's strategy here and how they conduct these workplace raids? I mean, is the bigger picture here, Randy, to just instill fear?
Well, there's much more pressure on ICE now, to be honest, because of all the negative publicity around family separation at the border, because of all the organizing against ICE operations at the local level. People are much more aware of the situation that these immigrant families face when someone is arrested than they were, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. ICE has responded, actually, in this case, by releasing at least 270 out of the 680 arrested people from this operation because they're primary caregivers of children. That's not something they probably would have done before. But on the other hand, they still have those other people in detention, many of whom are parents. So this family separation issue is front and center now in a way that it hasn't been before.
I want to think a little bit about the long-term impact here on not just the families, but on children. You're a child, you are an American citizen. In this case, many of these children are American citizens. You're going about your day-to-day life, and now you've been separated from one of your parents, hopefully just one of your parents. What is the long-term impact on these kids, Randy?
Well, we know that growing up in poverty is not good for children. And some of these families were poor to begin with, but they were working class. You know, their parents had a decent, stable job, and now the parent lost that job, and the parent may be gone. And that's, you know, going to put these children in a much more precarious financial situation for years to come. And that poverty can have an adverse developmental impact. Then, of course, there's going to be the psychological trauma for a while of not knowing what's going to happen to the parent who was arrested, maybe being permanently separated from them. That may cause some shifts in families. The remaining parent may, you know, become a partner or get married to somebody else. There's going to be instability in these children.
Randy Capps is the Director of Research for U.S. Programs at the Migration Policy Institute. Randy, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
On Monday, the Trump administration unveiled new rules for legal immigrants, denying them permanent residency or citizenship status if they use public benefits. Acting USCIS Director Ken Cuccinelli went on NPR's Morning Edition on Tuesday to defend the decision, where he called the public charge rule, quote, central to our immigration history. He went on to reinterpret the poem on the plaque of the Statue of Liberty.
Give me your tired and your poor who can stand on their own 2 feet and who will not become a public charge.
The bootstraps narrative has long been a part of American history, and Cuccinelli's remarks got me thinking about who historically has been welcome into this country, who is considered deserving of citizenship, and the idea that some are more of a burden than others. Ian Haney-Lopez is here to discuss, and he's a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Ian, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
I'm doing well and pleased to be able to join you.
So when you heard Ken Cuccinelli's words, and not just his what mentioned there, but on this recently announced public charge rule, what were your initial thoughts?
My initial thoughts were this is another edition of Donald Trump's dog whistle politics. This is another effort to try and connect up people of color with welfare to generate the message that state resources that are necessary for all working families are actually being wasted on undeserving people. And there's an important element here. The way this was linked, not just to welfare, but to the notion of scarcity, that we face a crisis of scarcity in our country and that undeserving people are taking our resources. To the extent we do face a crisis of scarcity, it's manufactured by massive tax cuts to billionaires, not by other working people drawing on public benefits as they seek to create a successful life for themselves and their children.
Now, Ian, I do want to bring in one point, though. Like, the Trump administration, it may be the latest example of this, but this has also been something that the U.S. government has done with other groups in the past. Can we talk a little bit about the history of how the U.S. government has either connected citizenship and race or has really decided who deserves to become a citizen?
It's important to connect it up. So this public charge law, everybody says, well, this is an 1882 law. Sure, it's part of when the federal government begins to regulate immigration in a serious way. And it corresponds with this idea that there are undeserving people who are entering the country. And so, you know, the public charge is associated also with illness, but it's also closely associated with the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act. And so from the inception of this country, we've had two traditions of immigration, two traditions of citizenship. One tradition says, welcome to the United States, come join this country, work hard, you or your children will be full members of this society. But another suppressed tradition, a tradition that we do not celebrate, but that is persistent, is a sense that some people will be here but do not deserve to be members of our society. And that applied to Native Americans. The United States did not fully grant birthright citizenship to Native Americans until 1940. It applied to immigrants who wanted to naturalize, that is, immigrants who wanted to gain citizenship, not by birth, but by naturalization. There was a restriction that said you had to be a white person in our naturalization laws until 1952. So we've always had this other tradition. It is applied with particular ugliness against Asians, against Mexicans, against African Americans, right? The whole Dred Scott case, there's always been this ugly tradition. Some people don't deserve to be American, and it's often been racialized. That's the conversation we're having again today.
I want to actually, and I want to bring that forward to the Ken Cuccinelli comment again, because really at the heart of the Emma Lazarus poem, for a lot of Americans, it points to this ideal that we welcome people into this country regardless of what they can contribute. Your
right.
Huddled masses yearning to breathe free.
Right.
Let's talk about at any point in our history, was that immigration policy embraced, or was it just part of an American narrative that made us feel better?
It's both. So there are cycles, and there are periods in which immigration to the United States is quite close to open and welcoming. That would be the sort of post-Civil War era, large-scale immigration from Europe through around 1920. You're starting to get these laws, but they're only loosely applied. So large-scale immigration is welcome from Europe, including Southern and Eastern Europe. the border is more or less porous and open with Mexico, and there's a sort of there's a circulatory migration pattern. People are coming back and forth. That changes. It changes. Well, even in that period, we should be clear, that was the era of the Chinese Exclusion Act, and there were and in fact, U.S. constitutional immigration law is founded on a series of cases that uphold the ability of Congress to exclude groups on the basis of racial dislike. There's a series of cases, Che Chan Ping and Fong Yuting, in which the court asks, can Congress exclude the Chinese because they're perceived as racially inferior? Mm-hmm. And the court says, yes, they're seen as an Oriental invasion. They're seen as a threat to the civilization on the West Coast. Congress has the power to exclude these people. So there's that happening, but the borders are more or less open for European immigration, more or less open, largely open in terms of the southern border. And yet there's a backlash develops, a narrative that says we're being flooded by racial inferiors. In this case, the supposed racial inferiors were Jews and Italians and Poles, Southern and Eastern European, non-Northern and Western European stock in the language of the time. And then the U.S. slams the border shut on Europe in 1921 and again 1924. And then with the Great Depression, and then again in the sort of the Red Scare in the 1950s, the United States begins to harden the border with Mexico and begins to limit immigration. So we go through these cycles, but there are times when we come closer to honoring the ideal that every person has the potential to contribute to society, and deserves to be the dignity of being recognized as a member of the society, and eras in which we go in a quite different direction, and nativism and xenophobia and racism, and frankly, I would not sharply distinguish those terms, that these combine to create a panic among the American public.
Ian Haney-Lopez is a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Ian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Forty years ago today, director Francis Ford Coppola's movie Apocalypse Now premiered in theaters. Set during the Vietnam War, the film centers on a group of U.S. soldiers on a mission to find and kill an American colonel who's gone rogue. Martin Sheen stars as Captain Willard, who leads the soldiers as they travel down a river into Cambodia.
When I was here, I wanted to be there. When I was there, all I could think of was getting back into the jungle.
Decades later, the film continues to shape the way younger generations think about and relate to the Vietnam War. And that's at least in part because Coppola has continued to tinker with his film, releasing an extended cut in 2001 and another re-edited version this week. Viet Thanh Nguyen, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book The Sympathizer, saw Apocalypse Now for the first time when he was about 10 years old.
We had just gotten a VCR. That was really advanced technology in the early 1980s. And Apocalypse Now was probably the third or fourth movie I might have seen there. It was about the Vietnam War, which was an event that had shaped my life, brought me to the United States as a refugee in 1975, and I was deeply fascinated by it, so I was naturally drawn to the story.
But what stood out most to Viet about the film, beyond the spectacle of it all, was how it depicted Vietnamese people. Not at the center of the story, but on its margins.
We hadn't really been portrayed at all in American media that I had seen. And then all of a sudden, in this very powerful, scary, terrifying movie, there were Vietnamese people. But our place in the movie was deeply problematic. Seeing Vietnamese people being murdered on screen affected me very deeply, probably more than I even understood when I was 10 or 11. And it left a scar on me that I would start to really think about many years later.
I asked Viet how his understanding of the film began to change once he was old enough to process its violent imagery.
Well, the pivotal moment in Apocalypse Now comes halfway through the movie when the American sailors encounter a Vietnamese boat full of civilians and then inadvertently massacre them. And I remember just being shocked by that and then putting it away somewhere in the back of my mind and then talking about that scene a decade later in college to a classroom and finding myself overcome with emotion, shaking with rage and anger. And as a critic, I can understand what Coppola was doing in that scene. He wants to portray the horror of war. He wants to portray how dehumanized the American soldiers have become. And yet, it's also being done at the expense of Vietnamese people, Vietnamese bodies. And I think that was what was so terribly shocking and angering for me, is a sense that we were being seen as victims, but we were being seen only as victims. We would never get the opportunity to speak or to express our own histories, our own ideas, not even a glimpse of our humanity or our point of view was going to be shown in this movie.
Was that also a form of dehumanization for the Vietnamese characters in the film?
Absolutely. And I think that Americans and people who are not Vietnamese who watch these kinds of movies and read these kinds of books, and there have been many books about the Vietnam War from the American point of view, would see this and think this is actually a humanizing portrayal of the Vietnamese, because here the American soldiers are being shown as being doing something terrible and these poor Vietnamese people are the victims. But victimization is a kind of dehumanization too. We don't really see victims as humans. We might pity them, but we also objectify them. And what clearly happens in the case of Apocalypse Now is that we see them, the scene and the entire movie really, from the American point of view. So even as the Americans are doing terrible things, we understand their complexity. We can sympathize with them. We understand the moral dilemmas that they're going through. And the Vietnamese people are simply silent bodies to be killed and to be disposed of for the American drama.
You have mentioned not just Apocalypse Now, but other American war movies, and you've called them a sort of cultural propaganda. What does that mean?
Well, what I mean by that is that Hollywood is the unofficial ministry of propaganda for the United States. Unlike the Chinese or the Soviets, we don't need an official ministry of propaganda. We don't have to dictate our ideology to people. Instead, Hollywood, I think, as liberal as it is, still nevertheless shares, generally, the values of capitalism, of American exceptionalism, of the military-industrial complex, and its movies advance these kinds of spectacles that even if they might ostensibly be anti-war, and that's very debatable with Apocalypse Now and all of these American war movies, even so, they portray the American point of view. They celebrate the American perspective, even from an anti-heroic way, and they make us identify with American perspectives. And they broadcast these American perspectives all over the world because the Hollywood industry is, just like the American military-industrial complex, a global one. And it's a form of soft power that gets the rest of the world to see history or stories or just entertainment from our point of view. And that's an enormously powerful form of propaganda.
Speaking of that type of propaganda, and at least that point of view, I want to read a quote here from Francis Ford Coppola from the premiere at Cannes of Apocalypse Now. And I'm quoting here, Coppola saying, "My film is not about Vietnam. It is Vietnam. The way we made it is the way Americans were in Vietnam. We had too much money, access to too much equipment, and little by little, we went insane." What's your reaction to that quote?
Well, it's it's a great quote for a writer or a critic to look at, and also for Coppola's own wife, who featured that pretty prominently in her documentary Hearts of Darkness about the making of Apocalypse Now. But, you know, I take it with some sympathy for Coppola. You know, he's a young man when he was making that movie and wrapped up in the drama of making the movie. But nevertheless, I think it does express this American solipsism, that everything about Vietnam for Americans is about the Vietnam War. Like, these two terms, Vietnam and the Vietnam War, are indistinguishable. And the Vietnam War for Americans is an American war. It's their obsession. 3 million Vietnamese people might have died in the Vietnam War, but that's inconsequential compared to the 58,000 Americans who died and the dramas and the pain and all the suffering and so on that Americans underwent. And Coppola, in depicting that, also transforms the drama of the making of his movie into a version of that American egocentric experience as well. So it's a perfect expression, I think, of the American point of view about what Vietnam means to Americans.
You said you were a refugee from Vietnam because of the war. Do you have any recollections of what that experience was like and how that, have you ever seen anything that is even remotely accurately depicted the experience that you and your family had to suffer through?
Well, thankfully, I don't remember anything about the Vietnam War. And I say thankfully because I know a lot of people who do remember things about the Vietnam War and the horrors that Vietnamese people underwent, including my own family. And from our point of view, you know, our historical experiences were not about combat and things like that, but were about fleeing the war zone as refugees. And that is a terribly traumatic experience for many people, even if they weren't soldiers. And, you know, I think that for me, the number of versions of this historical experience are relatively rare to encounter precisely because Vietnamese stories, whether they're books or movies, have been made about this war, but they rarely get exported out of Vietnam, or if they're made by Vietnamese Americans, they rarely get put into multiplexes and so on. But some very powerful ones in terms of movies are things like Journey from the Fall by the filmmaker Ham Tran, which is a pretty spectacular movie about the fall of Saigon and the refugee experience from a Vietnamese American point of view. But to put this into perspective, that movie probably took in $1 million or $2 million in box office, even though it was actually a very, very powerful movie. Or probably the most celebrated movie about the war from a Vietnamese point of view is When the Tenth Month Comes by Dong Nhat Minh, who was Vietnam's premier Revolutionary Generation director, which was released in 1978, so roughly the same time as Apocalypse Now. And you see Apocalypse Now, it's a multicolor extravaganza that cost tens of millions of dollars. When the Tenth Month Comes, made it roughly the same time, a small, intimate, black and white movie that looks like it came out of the 1950s. And so these are the inequalities of memory that the Vietnamese people face.
Let's talk a little bit about the role of the director here in these films and the media that creates these films. You've written a book called The Sympathizer, where the main character becomes a consultant on a war movie that has echoes of Apocalypse Now. Tell me about what you were trying to capture in that work about how these films are made.
In one of my other books, I say that all wars are fought twice, the first time on the battlefield, the second time in memory. And certainly the way that Hollywood has treated the Vietnam War has been this second war in memory. That from the 1970s through the early 2000s, Hollywood made dozens of movies about the Vietnam War, and it's still not finished. Spike Lee is going to make a movie. Michael Mann is making a movie about the Vietnam War. I'm sort of terrified about what they're going to do. But, you know, in these movies, they're really America's attempt to refight the war from an American perspective. And that was, you know, I grew up in the 1970s and 1980s watching many of these movies. And I don't recommend that exercise to anybody, especially if you're Vietnamese. And I was deeply traumatized by watching these highly repetitive portrayals of American masculine dramas at the expense of Vietnamese people. And so when I wrote The Sympathizer, I thought, now's my time to take revenge on Hollywood. And so there's a whole section of the book which satirizes these American movies about the war. Apocalypse Now is not the only one. It's just, I think, probably the most famous or infamous one, and certainly one of the most powerful ones aesthetically. But really, the satirization is about the entire apparatus of how Americans have thought about Vietnam and how they have tried to win the war again in movies.
There are certain moments in American history that have become obsessions of filmmakers and documentarians and beyond. And Vietnam and the Vietnam War, I should say, has been one of them. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think a number of reasons. I mean, as many people have said, the Vietnam War is the first war that Americans clearly lost. And the second one, I think, is that it was such an intimate war for Americans in ways that wars before and after have not been. So it's been famously referred to as the first television war or the first living room war because Americans could watch these images of the war every night in their own homes. And these images were very, very graphic and very vivid and very immediate. So events that happened could be seen the same day or the next day in the United States. And the preceding wars that the United States have gone through have had an insulating effect with the media that we didn't have that same kind of immediacy. And in the wars that have come afterwards, the United States government, the Pentagon, has learned its lesson. There was a lot of blame placed at the feet of the media for turning American public opinion against the war in Vietnam. So ever since, we've had very limited access to the images of war that the United States have fought. So the war in Vietnam remains very particular in the American imagination, both in terms of the way that it seems to have destroyed American ambitions and in the way that it's shown the effects of the war so graphically, so spectacularly, so vividly for Americans to see and to remember.
Another cultural piece here, at least from the American perspective, about the Vietnam War is Miss Saigon. You recently wrote about the musical in the New York Times. Tell me how your critique of Apocalypse Now compares to your critique of Miss Saigon.
Well, Miss Saigon's obviously a huge Broadway hit, and it stirs a lot of affection on the part of many viewers. And the typical response of viewers to Miss Saigon is to say, this is a beautiful love story about a Vietnamese prostitute who falls in love with an American soldier. They have a child together. He runs back to the United States. She's desperate to get her child out of the country. He comes back, and he's already married another American woman. So she gives up the child back to this American soldier, and then she kills herself. So many people interpret this as a great love story, possibly even a critique of what the United States did in Vietnam. But for me, it's a deeply problematic story because it repeats many of the same stereotypes that Westerners and Americans like to return to when it comes to Asians, particularly Asian women. It may or may not be a great love story, but the only place that Asians or Asian women can occupy in this Western imagination is to be the ones that die. So yes, in Miss Saigon, there is more subjectivity given to the Vietnamese prostitute, certainly more than in Apocalypse Now. She gets lines, you know, she gets to sing songs and so on, but she's going to die. And the only way that Americans can imagine salvation, or Westerners can imagine salvation, is to be rescued and sent to the United States. So these are deeply held tropes, ideas, stories in the American or Western imagination that Americans have a hard time giving up. And when people like me criticize them, people get very, very sensitive.
We're on the anniversary of Apocalypse Now, and it's being rescreened in theaters around the country. How should or should people watch the film? And if so, how should they do so?
Well, first, I think Apocalypse Now is a great work of art. I actually enjoy watching it. I teach it every time I teach my class on the Vietnam War. And it's also a racist work of art. And there is no contradiction necessarily between these two things. Coppola drew a lot of inspiration from Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. And Chinua Achebe, the great Nigerian novelist who wrote Things Fall Apart, wrote a very powerful essay criticizing Heart of Darkness for being a very racist novel. Now, it's possible to imagine that Heart of Darkness is a great novel, and yet its depiction of Africans is also racist. And I think that's exactly what happens in Apocalypse Now. I'm not taking away anything from its aesthetic accomplishments. I'm not taking away anything from its depiction of the American psyche or American character. But that drama is based on the erasure and the exploitation and silencing of Vietnamese people. And so I hope audience goers are aware of this kind of complexity when they watch Apocalypse Now. I hope they don't simply go there and walk away enjoying the spectacle, because people do enjoy the spectacle, and not think about how important the erasure of Vietnamese people is to the centering of American experience.
Viet Thanh Nguyen is the author of The Sympathizer and The Refugees. Viet, thank you so much for your insights and for your time.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.